Hi, this is Scott Wilkinson, host of Home Theater Geeks. In episode 297, InnerFidelity.com editor Tile Hertzens answers questions from the chat room about headphones. So stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, recorded March 24th, 2016. Episode 297, Headphone Q&A. This episode of Home Theater Geeks is brought to you by Corning Optical Cables. Corning's incredibly durable Thunderbolt and USB 3.0 optical cables are longer, thinner, lighter, and stronger. Go to opticalcablesbycorning.com to learn more. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here, the home theater geek and editor of absforum.com. This week's guest geek is Tile Hertzens, editor-in-chief of InnerFidelity.com, and one of the most popular guests on the show. Tile, I think this is about number 10 or 11 of your appearances here. Welcome.
Thanks, Scott. It's always great to be here, and I'm looking forward to it. We're going to spend some time in the chat room today, and that should be a lot of fun.
You bet. You bet. So that's what we're doing today. We're going to be answering questions from the chat room about headphones. So if you have any questions about headphones, what to buy, what you have, what how to make it work better, this is the time to do it and the place to do it. Those of you who are tuned in live at live.twit.tv have that opportunity to join the chat room there or at irc.twit.tv. And you can post questions in there. I'll be looking at them and passing them on to Tile. If you put my screen name, Scott Wilkinson, no dots or dashes or spaces, then it shows up in a different color on my screen and makes it easier to see. So I do recommend that you do that. let's see. Let's start with Sandblaster. He says, and I'm not 100% sure I know what this means, current flatline headphones are Audio-Technica ATH-M50s, and for more bass, EDM, electronic dance music, Sony MRDXB500s.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure exactly what he means by that either, except to say that I do find the ATH-M50X, the new one, not the M50 without the X suffix, to be a pretty darn neutral little headphone. I mean, it has some unevenness to it. You know, it's not as good as a very expensive closed headphone, but it certainly is very neutral. And I don't necessarily think I'd call it flatline in the sense that, nobody knows what flat is on headphones, really.
And then, yes. And then,
that's a whole discussion in and of itself. And then I like to have a little extra bass bump in the as measured on headphones. The Harman response curve thinks that is probably appropriate and should be called flat to get a little extra bass starting under about 150 hertz, which, as I recall, the ATH-M50X has a bit of that. So it's a very nice little headphone. As far as the XB500s go or any of the Sony extra bass headphones, you know, if music has got to have a lot of bass punch in it to do what it needs to do, EDM or dance music or something like that, it's in there. And you don't need to artificially accentuate it too much. And I actually like the XB500 of the Sony extra bass headphones, but boy, I really wouldn't recommend them unless you come up to me and say, "Hey, I'm a raging basshead lunatic, and I want something that can do that for me. What do you want?" You know. And in those cases, actually, these Vmoda M100s I like for bassheads. I think they're actually a really good headphone for bassheads.
Well, would you call them sort of the best for bassheads, or is there something even better, or are those like your value pick?
I'd say it's my value pick, although there aren't very many headphones with really a significant amount of extra bass that I would recommend, even going more up in price. I don't know. I think it's kind of the only bass headphone I've recommended. Of course, the Odyssey headphones have a tremendous bass slam. In fact, just recently I heard just got them in a couple days ago, the new Odyssey Sign headphones. And these are a $400 or $499 on-ear planar magnetic sealed headphone. And man, do they have some kick and bass? So that may come into the fray as the a new recommendation for people who want some slam and bass.
Mm-hmm. How much are the Vmodas?
I think they're $299, but okay. Been a while since I looked.
A little less, but still not cheap per se.
Yeah, yeah, and a really well built headphone too. It's great on a number of levels, except it's not an audiophile headphone. It isn't neutral, so.
Mm. Well, but you mentioned the Harman curve.
Yeah.
And we might call that flat, but in fact, it's not flat. So what do you mean by neutral or audiophile in that sense? I mean, should an audiophile headphone that might be classified as neutral have that Harman curve?
Yeah. Nobody knows, Scott. I mean, that's the problem. I can tell you that Philips did a lot of subjective studies with people, and they had a pretty cool way of doing it. They did it on an iPad and had this sort of array with a dot on it, and you could move the dot around, and in one dimension it would make the curve do this, and in the other dimension it would make the curve do this.
Ah.
And they would get people to express their preferences by moving this dot around, and they really couldn't, there wasn't any visual cue to what they were doing. And then they'd have them do it again, and without the person knowing, they'd flip the axes around in different positions, so they could weight the input less from people who wouldn't consistently put the dot in the same place. Mm. And in the end, they did find that people wanted more bass than what is measured as flat. And of course, I have to go through a whole big la-di-da-da about headphones are measured on a head with artificial pinna and artificial ear canals and microphones that have the same acoustic compliance as eardrums and all sorts of complicated stuff. And the line that it draws, if you were assuming a headphone that was actually flat, if you measured it up against a flat plate or something, but the curve that results is not a flat line, but it should have these various characteristics. Really, if you go search for the Harman target response curve on InterFidelity, I've got three or four articles about it. But the bottom line is that at the moment it's still an estimate, and I'm not sure whether Sean Olive at Harman is going to delve into it too much further, because at some point it becomes less. They're doing research to give the general gist of the idea to the world as in terms of scientific research, and then at some point they go into industrial research and they close the doors and they don't tell you anymore what they're doing. So
right.
So I'm sure they have something in mind for what's right, but I'm not sure we'll ever see it explicitly.
Yeah. Speaking of measurements, and we've talked about this on the show before, where you have a really quite detailed model head with, in particular, detailed ear structures, and you stick little microphones in there, and you put the headphones on, and you do these measurements, which is quite interesting. I don't think you saw last week's show. I was talking with Bob Schuline and Dan Mapes Riordan about some high resolution audio tests that they've done, and I encourage people to go check out that podcast. The reason I bring it up here, though, is that I was amazed at how Bob actually did some measurements of headphones with a microphone in his own ear. He didn't use a head. He used his own ears, and he actually put the microphone, he said, barely touching his eardrum. Well, that really gave me the creeps.
Yeah, those are called capillary microphones, and it's just a very, very thin tube. And I've had those inserted in my ear canals before. I went to visit Edemotic, and they wanted to let me see measurements of my own ear canals. And the point that they were making when they did this to me, unbeknownst to me at the time, So they put these microphones in my ear, the little thin, it's like a hair almost, up against, you could actually hear when you touched the eardrum, it goes point.
Yeah, yeah.
And you go, holy smoke, you know, and then
but
it's okay. And then they taped it to the side of my head, and then they put me in a room, sort of the opposite of an anechoic chamber. It's a very live concrete room with speakers in all the corners, and pumped it up with calibrated pink noise, so you have pink noise, a diffuse field of pink noise in the room.
But you're not wearing headphones at that point.
No. In this case, they're just measuring my ears and
your
and,
ear response. Okay.
Well, actually, it's just the acoustics of how my physiology filtered the sound before it got to my eardrums, because they don't, they really can't measure what's happening after that, but they can, but they can show you what the response is at your eardrum relative to this room. And it has this characteristic shape curve with a peak at about 3 kilohertz, and then it falls back down again. And the interesting thing and what they wanted to show me was that the frequency response, or the, not the frequency response, the acoustic transmission to the eardrum on both sides of my head were different. So each channel, each of my ears has a different acoustic response along that path. And that response could vary up to, in terms of difference, 10 dB of difference in some spots. They say is normal. And mine was like 5 dB or something, which is a little better than normal, but it's normal for there to be a pretty substantial difference in just what the sound that gets to your eardrum. And the upshot of all of that, of course, is that your brain figures all that out over the course of your life, and you never hear it.
Yeah, yeah. Wow, that's really, really interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, getting back to the questions, Compter is asking, for noise-canceling headphones, are the Bose QC25 still the best? I myself really like them. I spent some years ago listening to various noise-canceling headphones, and PSB, Paul Barton, makes a very nice noise canceller. But I always come back to the Bose, I got to tell you, even though I'm not really a big Bose fan by any means, but their noise-canceling headphones, I really like. What's your opinion?
Yeah, they really have done it very, very well. Their first one, I think, was a QC3 or something like that, or the first one I became aware of was a Q2. Yeah, and it might have gone further back than that, but I hadn't become aware of them.
Right.
Because at the time I was a CEO of Headroom, which sold headphones, and we couldn't get a certified dealership with Bose, because we just weren't big enough or whatever, or we'd sold too much online, or at any rate. But over the years, once they got to the QC15, it was like, boy, this is a lot better than I'd heard noise cancelers before. And that was now 8 years ago or something like that. And then the QC25 came out a couple years ago or a year ago. And I like it a lot. And I've heard a lot of noise canceling headphones. The trend right now is more towards wireless. You know, there's a lot more wireless headphones, and noise canceling is one of those things that is just beginning to get thrown into the mix. You know, once they get the electronics and the headset and stuff like that, they say, well, let's do some noise canceling. And to date, nobody has done it anywhere near as good as Bose has to my ears. I mean, they have nailed it. And I think in the final analysis, it's a intellectual property issue that Bose has just been doing it a long time and kind of covered the field with patents and it's it's just hard for people to get wiggle room to find a way to do something without either paying the licensing fee to Bose to get as good as them or or trying to do it differently with as good an outcome. But but the Bose are pretty good. But I tell you, one thing that's getting less and less with noise-canceling headphones is a general case is that it used to be when you flipped them on, you almost got a sense of vertigo, that it was really weird sounding a lot of times when you turned on a noise-canceling headphone. And that's kind of going away. The noise-canceling stuff that's out there now is I would say it's as good as the QC15 was. So the noise cancelers are getting better in general. And then I'll also mention that there's some weird things that happen with noise canceling headphones. They have microphones both inside and outside of the enclosure. There's quite a few microphones that pick up sound to figure out exactly what kind of canceling signal to make. And when I got the Beats Studio wireless noise canceler, you can't turn the noise canceling off. So it's on all the time. And if you lay in bed and watch my iPad, and if I had a pillow that was soft and it would come up around the earphones, and what it would do is would create this sort of a chamber that started the headphones breaking into this chuffing oscillation like this.
Wow.
And after a while I go, what is this? And after a while I figured it out, and you could take a hoodie and put a hoodie over it. And if the hood was not a hoodie, but a hood from a jacket. And if it was sort of stiff enough, it would cause it to happen. And since then, I've heard it on a couple of other headphones too. The Sennheiser Momentum 2 wireless broke into oscillation if you put your hands up next to it. But it was a high frequency, a high pitched oscillation. I think they've solved that problem. I think that was early on. But you can have some pretty weird things happen with noise canceling headphones. But yeah, Bose is good. And let me add, there's a QC20 that looks like an in-ear monitor, but the tips, it's like just putting your fingertips in your ear. They don't go in deep at all. They don't really seal. They just kind of rest there. And it works stunningly well as well. It's an amazing little headphone. And they're not even really sealed. If you turn it off, you can hear pretty much everything that's going on around you, but you turn it on and it's like, wow. So yeah, Bose pretty much kills it in the noise canceling headphone department.
Now, before we leave noise canceling, let me just ask you this. The ability to cancel noise is one thing. And I agree. Bose is the best I've heard, but most people will also want to listen to music.
Right.
And so the question is, how does the noise canceling affect music playback, or does it? And which one, in your experience, sounds the best for music?
Yeah, it's still the Bose is the answer. There's a bit of a complication. For example, Meelectronics has a new wireless headphone called the Matrix. And it has a separate switch for turning the noise canceling on and off. And I really like that when they do that. A lot of times it's either just on or not, or the whole headphone's off. You can run it off a wire, or if you run it, under batteries, the noise canceler is always on. But in that headphone, it's pretty obvious that you can hear the difference in the character of the sound when you turn the noise canceler on and off. I've never heard a noise canceling headphone that can get the kind of fidelity you can get on just a passive headphone. But I'll tell you, it's just another weird thing about noise cancelers, and you kind of don't realize it until you manage to discover it for yourself. But the other thing that noise cancelers cancel out is the mechanical noise of your body. When you have sealed headphones over your head and you turn the music off, you can hear your heart beat. You can hear your jaw move around. There's rumbling noises from rubbing up against your collar and things like that. And noise cancelers will kill that noise as well. And so even if like a lot of times I'll sit out on my porch and watch my iPad and in the winter have a cigarette. And yes, that's a sad thing. I go back and forth, but
no judgment.
But I'll often have a coat that's got a collar on it and stuff like that. And I'll often use a noise canceller because I don't get all the rustling and the body sounds. Yeah. And then the other thing, of course, that happens is your psychological accommodation to the character of the sound. When you flip the switch and go between, you can pretty much instantly hear, oh, yeah, I'm missing some of the, you know, lower mid-range or whatever it happens to be, some honky character when you have the noise canceller on. But in the end, when you turn the noise canceller on and then you just sit there and watch, pretty soon it kind of doesn't matter anymore. So if you're not talking about, you know, critical listening or not, I shouldn't say critical listening, but you know, real, deep, pure listening for enjoyment that an audiophile would do. There are reasons for having a noise canceller on, even if you're not on an airplane, just to kind of make everything a little blacker. Well, you know, it's like watching a video screen in a dark room versus a room with a lot of distraction. And that analogy is pretty close.
Yeah. You know, I've thought of that analogy before myself in terms of, the noise floor versus the black level on a TV.
Right.
And you know, the lower you can get in the noise floor, the sort of more the music pops out. And again, like the deeper the black is on the screen, the more the image pops out. So that's kind of cool.
Yeah. I don't want to throw out too much of a spoiler here, but I'm going to be publishing a review on the new Odyssey LCD-4 tomorrow.
Oh,
and one of the things is that they really did a lot of work in cleaning up spurious sources of distortion and resonances. And as a result, they made the headphone quite a bit cleaner than previous versions of that headphone, which I've always liked, but also had some sort of tendencies of not liking some of the things that were going on the treble, but I really could never put my finger on it. And now that they've made the headphone even cleaner, I was able to put my finger on exactly what I didn't like about the treble.
Wow. That's so cool. So you're posting that tomorrow?
Yeah, they're not going to think it's cool, but...
Okay, well, you heard it here first, folks.
So there's a spoiler for you guys in the chat room.
Yeah, be sure to go and check out the Audie's review on innerfidelity.com for sure. Okay, let's go to another question here. R2S2 is asking, any recommendations for headphones for the hearing impaired, particularly high frequency loss?
Yeah.
That's a tough question.
Yeah, I think the first answer to that is go see your audiologist, right?
Yeah. Get a hearing profile. Get a hearing test. See where you are. You might have to then do some EQing to boost up those high frequencies to where they sound kind of normal to your particular hearing loss.
Well, I tell you a funny thing. And to answer the question, I don't really have any good advice. But I can tell you an interesting thing. When I worked for Headroom, we had a guy call up one time and he says, I have high frequency hearing loss. And he sent us his chart from the hearing profile. He says, and this was early on. And he says, can you put in a filter to make it brighter? Cause we had a brightness. There was a switch on there that we could make it a little brighter, but he wanted it brighter yet. So because when he turned on our crossfeed processor, it rolled it off a little bit. And so we had a filter switch to compensate for it. So we modified the box for him and sent it off. And then he calls back and he goes, you know, I think you've gone too far. It's a little too bright.
Wow.
And we actually went back and forth a couple of times. And in the end, we put the original part back in the switch and the switch did make it a little bit brighter. And he says, yeah, that's right. You know, and so the thing to learn from that is that your brain is really it's like the difference between my two ear canals, you know.
Yeah.
Your brain is really good at figuring stuff out. And so if you compensate for it with some sort of a tonal change and the rest of your world doesn't change, in other words, when you take the headphones off and you still talk to people and you're hearing through normal conditions, that new presentation on the headphones is going to sound too bright, even if it just completely, you know, compensates for the hearing loss that you have. But it's going to sound too bright relative to the sound of the world around you when you're not listening to the headphones.
Ah, interesting. Yes, yeah. There you go.
And so the thing about hearing aids is that once you use them all the time, you know, then you get used to it. You might be able to take the hearing aids out and then put in a pair of headphones and then dial in a profile that's like what the hearing aids are and hear the detail better. And then the last little thing I'll mention about it is they've done studies where people have catastrophic hearing loss of some type, partial hearing loss in one ear. Mm. And then they run tests on them to over a period of time to test how well they're accommodating to this catastrophic, you know, sudden hearing loss. And they find within a course of about 3 weeks that their ability to localize sound and things like that around them in general get back to within kind of – it just depends on the hearing loss, of course, but generally gets back to 80% of one's normal ability to localize sound because Wow. Your brain compensates. Yeah. And even people who only hear in one ear learn how to accommodate by tonal changes and reflections off the one ear. So it's just amazing, you know, what your brain can figure out. So you have to be a little careful about just saying, oh, I've got some high end hearing loss. I can turn it up and it'll sound better. It's not quite that simple.
No. All right. Barfel in the chat room is saying, I'm thinking about adding a headphone amp to my system connected to one of the two aux outs on my AVR. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
but the AVR is not close to my favorite seat in the theater. I have LSTN phones. I don't know what that is. Do you know what that is?
I think I've heard of them. I don't think I've listened to any. Maybe at a trade show.
Yeah, okay. Is that a brand, LSTN?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So, Barfel, if you can give us a little more information about those phones.
I won't have heard them anyway.
Yeah. But what do you think about headphone amps? I mean, you do a lot with headphone amps as well.
Well, yeah, sure. I kind of invented the headphone amplifier in some
ways. That's true, you did.
Yeah, yeah, Headroom made the first USB headphone amp, the first portable headphone phone amp, the first balanced headphone amp. There were only a couple of headphone amps out there before we started. That said, I think the headphone amp is like the least important thing in the of source
really?
amplifier headphones. Yeah, the headphones are the most important thing by far, and then I think the source is the next most important thing. Although I could make arguments in the other direction, and then the amp after that, and the differences between amplifiers are far, far less than the differences between the headphones. So, to some extent, you want to look for a headphone amplifier based on things like the price and the features and whether you want it to be portable or not, or USB, or how many inputs you want it to have, and so on and so forth. And then after that, worry about sound quality of the amplifiers and doing some research on the forums online for sound quality information. But really, it's a matter of price and performance and things. Was there any more to his question? Because
didn't seem to be. But let me just to take a look down here.
One of the things that sometimes people ask is it better to run the interconnect cables to the amp and have the amp close to you, or is it better to run short interconnects to the amp and then have a long headphone extension?
Good question.
Yeah, that is a good question. And the answer is it's probably better to run a headphone extension than run the long interconnect cables, except you better have a remote control for the volume control at that point. So it gets the volume control out of the picture. But, you know, as long as you're talking about a reasonable distance, you know, 10 meters max or something like that, it kind of doesn't matter too much, you know, as long as you buy reasonable quality cables.
Right. Either way, neither of those kinds of cables, typically interconnects or headphone cables, are the interconnects are shielded. Headphone cables often aren't, except if you're in the high end. So that might be another reason to do long interconnects, because they would be probably more shielded.
Well, the problem is that the output impedance and input impedance of the line level chain is higher than the output impedance of the headphone amplifier, which is usually 10 ohms or less. And having a low impedance on that line makes interference develop less voltage. So low impedance line would have less interference, even if it wasn't shielded potentially. In either case, you're kind of splitting hairs for that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. What are your favorite headphone amps these days?
Well, I recently reviewed the Headamp GSX Mark II, which is just a glorious amplifier, lovely amplifier. It leans to a tad bright, and I tend to like things a tad warm, so it's not quite my cup of tea. But it nonetheless is a beautifully articulate and well controlled amplifier. But I chose for my reference headphone amplifier here in my lab the SimAudio Moon Neo 430HA, which is a $3,000 roughly amplifier. It's not quite as articulate. It comes close, but you can clearly tell it's not quite as articulate as the Headamp is. But it has features galore, lots of ins and outs and things like that. So it has a really fine volume control. So it's more useful to me as a reviewer, and it's got just incredible power handling capability. So it'll drive any headphone pretty much with ease. So that's a headphone I like a lot. Another headphone I like a lot is the little Eddy Current Black Widow. Although I'm not sure they're making them at the moment, but it was up here for my big sound thing, and it was just a lovely sounding amplifier. And then lastly, the ones I like to throw out there is the Bottlehead Crack, which is a do-it-yourself kit that costs a couple $100. And I've got a video on how to build it, and it's a great project for somebody to, after they've made a few cables and have the basic gist of how to solder, it's a great little amplifier to build, not only because it's fairly simple to build, but it gives you the opportunity to do the tube rolling and stuff. And then there are also numerous modifications to it. One of them is called the Speedball, which is a constant current source for it. But there's also in the Bottlehead forums, there's all sorts of things that people tweak and on it and stuff. So it's a really a cool gadget for people to get their hands dirty and build something. So I love that little amplifier.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, good. There's more questions in the chat room, which we'll get to in just a minute. But before we do, I'd like to take a moment to thank our sponsor for this episode, which is Corning Optical Cables. Now, Corning has transformed the traditional USB and Thunderbolt cables from plain old copper into incredibly durable fiber optic speed demons. Whether you're into high-end video, photography, audio production, or computing, you want the best, most reliable cables out there. Now take a look at Corning's Thunderbolt and USB 3-point optical cables. Corning is known for fiber optics, and when you think of fiber, you think of glass, right? And glass breaks! But Corning has figured out how to make their USB and Thunderbolt cables super strong and flexible. So flexible, in fact, you can bend them, walk on them, even tie them in a knot, and they keep transmitting at top speed. Here, for example, is a Corning USB 3-point optical cable that connects to basically sends data to my printer. And I tied it in a knot here, and I wasn't at all sure I should make the knot that small. But a Corning representative that I ran into at a trade show said, "Oh, sure, no problem." And he took the cable and went, "Rat!" And I, oh, my goodness, look at that. And it still keeps printing just fine. It works perfectly well. There's no problem at all. I even roll over it with my computer chair sometimes, my desk chair, and it has never skipped a beat. So that is really quite amazing. Now, speaking of speed, Corning fiber optic cables provide incredible data rates, so up to 20 gigabits per second for Thunderbolt and 5 gigabits per second for USB. No other cable comes close. Another interesting fact, Corning optical cables are 50% thinner and 80% lighter than traditional copper cables. Corning optical cables have exceptional cable runs, too, up to 60 meters or 200 feet for Thunderbolt and 50 meters or 165 feet for USB 3. Now you can declutter, moving your peripherals into another room, improving productivity, and increasing security by putting expensive gear out of the way. Corning optical cables are longer, thinner, lighter, and stronger. Go to opticalcablesbycorning.com to learn more. And we thank Corning very much for their support of Home Theater Geeks. So, we are talking with Tyle Hertzens, headphone maven extraordinaire, and Mahler Music has posed the question, the next question, which is, what is the next big breakthrough in headphone technology for better sound quality that will change how headphones are made? Now, headphones have been around for a long time, and the technology hasn't changed that much. I mean, it's basically a speaker sitting next to your ear. Is there anything new that you know coming down the pike that that might change all of that?
Oh, boy. Yeah.
But you can't tell us or you'd have to kill us, right?
No, I could go into this at length. But I want to run something by you here for just a second, because you said headphones have been around a long time and they're just two speakers next to your ears. Well, I'm going to take exception to that, because if you there's a thing called the loudspeaker and headphone handbook, and in there's one chapter out of a very thick book that is kind of the only resource anywhere I've ever found that gives you what amount to the teal small parameters for a speaker.
Just so, remind us again what the teal small parameters are.
Oh, it's things like the enclosure size and enclosed air chamber and the diameter of the drivers and the primary resonance of the drivers and the crossover elements and blah, blah, blah.
All and that kind of stuff. Okay.
Yeah, you end up with a chunk of formula that's maybe this big on a page or something. The same formula for headphones is about four times bigger.
Huh.
Because there's just a lot going on in there that, you know, speakers in the end just put sound out into space and headphones don't.
So good point.
You're literally listening inside a resonant chamber. So and you have to create leaks in that chamber and leaks behind the driver and leaks between the driver and that chamber and how the pads bounce against the side of your head and all this stuff. So the truth is, from my perspective, Sennheiser kind of got their act together in the 90s with the HD 560, I think, was kind of the first really good sounding headphone, and it started going from there. But really, there was never a lot of money in headphones until Beats came along and smartphones came along. And so really, headphones are, in terms of their developmental life cycle, just getting off the ground. So we're still in like elementary school in a lot of ways in headphones, but that is changing really rapidly, mainly because there's a lot of money in headphones right now. I mean, it's a big market out there. And there's a lot changing in headphones, and headphones are now, when I'm talking about traditional wired headphones, are now getting quite a bit better kind of across the board. But there's another thing coming along hot and heavy, which is immersive audio and the ability to create three-dimensional soundscapes that seem like they're coming from outside of your head on headphones.
From all directions, including overhead.
Everywhere, yeah, because gamers want to use it. That's one of the big driving forces. But there's also a lot of desire for this kind of immersion of audio for smart headphones. Soon, we will start seeing headphones. Well, we already can see headphones that have biometric sensors in there, heartbeat, temperature, sweat, vibration sensors that that could tell when your footfall hits the ground, so you can feel that.
Count your steps, in other words, kind of like a Fitbit in your headphones.
Right, exactly. Exactly that. But then taking that even a step further, there's this desire to wear a headphone as a display for your smartphone, and you say to your smartphone, where's the railroad station? And all of a sudden you hear from behind you over to one side, the railroad station is over here, and you go to look in that direction, and then the sound lines up with what you're coming. So the sound is coming from very specific places. And the best example of where this would be incredibly valuable is for blind people, because, of course, they have very little opportunity to gain situational awareness of their surroundings. I mean, they literally have to go up to a store, open the door, and say, hey, what kind of store this is? Mm. And with these kinds of headphones, there could literally be a background narration that's going along as they're walking around, you know, Rexall drugstore, you know, Joe's Automotive Place, First Street 20 yards away, First Street 10 yards away, you know. So, and then, of course, for home theater, for decoding surround and convincingly giving you a sense of immersion. Now, the reason why I kind of go off on that tangent is that in order to trick your head into thinking that this sound is coming from outside your head, you have to do some very precise tuning of the head-related transfer function cues and how they change as your head's moving around. So they're going to have some pretty powerful DSP engines in there doing that. And one of the things those DSP engines are going to be able to do is compensate for any driver inadequacy. You can imagine in the future when you have DSP in the headphones that they might design headphones primarily on whether they can get the driver to act without any modal breakup and have the driver act perfectly linearly without regard to the frequency response. And then, so they have a driver that they can tell it to do anything they want it to do. And in its natural state without processing isn't very flat. But then as soon as they turn the processing on, they can make it dead flat. Well, as a result, if they can create this immersive audio thing really well, there could be just a switch setting where you go, you know, audiophile, and you push a button and it comes out with a neutral flat response, very good resolution. And it may be that these very smart DSP driven headphones end up, and these will be consumer products in the $300 to $500 neighborhood, probably, that these headphones may actually become better sounding than passive headphones of any price, because, you know, all the control has to be done acoustically, which is very, very difficult. So I think we're about to see a lot of change in the world of headphones. And I think the first hint of that, in a way, is Apple's release of the iPhone 7, which is supposedly not going to have a 3.5 millimeter headphone jack on it. And I think that's going to throw the mark.
Bluetooth or?
No, it uses a Lightning connector.
Oh, Lightning. Oh, okay. It comes out of the Lightning connector. All right.
Right. And so I'm sure.
So you think they're going to throw more DSP at the headphone output then?
Well, I think what they're actually trying to do is put the rest of the market behind them. So they pull the 3.5 millimeter headphone jack off their iPhone. The 3.5 millimeter headphone jack is probably the most hated audio connector in the world. How many people haven't had a portable audio device with an intermittent jack on it? Right, it's because this jack gets yanked and twisted, and it's very small in size and so on.
Right.
In fact, Apple patented a flexible 3.5 millimeter headphone jack, so when it got yanked out, it wouldn't break it. But they never built one. So now they're going to get rid of that jack, and everybody is going to be scrambling to have a version of their headphone that is either Bluetooth, because Bluetooth will work, or it has the Lightning connector on it if they want to connect to an iPhone, which, okay, they don't own the market in iPhones, you know, in smartphones, but they have a pretty good chunk
of it. Pretty big share, yeah.
Yeah, and Beats, who is owned by Apple, does have the lion's share of, you know, expensive or over $100 headphones. 56% of all headphones over $100 or something like that is Beats. So I think what happens is as soon as they pull that jack out, then the world kind of says, well, you know, goodbye, so long, sorry to see
good
you
riddance.
Go, but and good riddance to the 3.5 million. Now I have to take all my headphones and throw them out and buy wireless headphones or maybe go with a thing. But anyway, it's going to have a lot of people focusing on what are we going to do with the demise of the 3.5 millimeter headphone jack. Meanwhile, Apple and Beats are one company now, and they're working already, I'm sure, hot and heavy on this immersive audio, 3D audio thing. So I think they're trying to stir up the market and position themselves like 3 years from now when they come out with this kind of stuff to just be light years ahead of everybody else.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a complicated story, though, but it's an interesting one.
But it's a really interesting one. So, yeah.
Really, because, see, here's the other part of it that's really interesting. Apple is its own ecosystem of IT, you know, its own system of computerization and stuff. So they have no compatibility issues. But if you want immersive audio from a Sennheiser headphone on an Android phone or a Windows, you know, laptop or Hitachi or whatever, you know, they're not going to have lightning jacks. And so the world, apart from Apple, has to come up with their own competing standard for immersive audio, which is extremely complicated because you have head-related transfer functions and motion sensors and all sorts of stuff to interface. And they're already going to have a hell of a time just pulling everything together and converging it into a useful thing for consumers, whereas Apple just has to satisfy themselves and then they can produce it. So I think Apple is set to just make a huge move on the rest of the headphone market. And people are just going to be all over the place figuring out how to do it. And we'll get a lot of products made by one company that are good at the moment, you know, but that don't fit the standard that eventually comes out and become obsolete pretty quick. I mean, we're going to have a lot of products that pop up and go away and I don't know. Well, should be interesting times in the headphone world.
Should be interesting. Undermind agrees. Thinks the next advancement in headphone audio will be 3D positional sound driven by VR and object-based audio like DTS:X or Atmos. That's coming from the gaming world probably as much or more than from the movie world.
Yep, exactly right. Exactly right. Well, and with like that Microsoft stuff where you this mixed reality where you have a goggle that allows you to
reality.
Yeah, augmented reality. Yeah. It's going to be a fascinating time.
Emily the Strange asks, any advice on sports headphones, ones for swimming in particular?
You know, I don't do a lot with sports headphones because I'm so focused on audiophile kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But I do have some experience, and my experience to date leads me to believe that the Sennheiser Athletic headphones are the way to go. And this is not necessarily due to sound quality stuff. It's just the quality of manufacture and their ability to do that just on an ongoing basis. Those guys really know how to make headphones. So I wouldn't be afraid at all looking at the Sennheiser headphone. And while you were doing your commercial, I read some of the chats. Somebody asked for the best bass in earbuds for less than $50. Okay, earbuds are the ones that don't have tips in your ear canals, right? These just rest in the concha ridge of your ear. And the best earbuds I've ever heard are the Apple EarPods.
No kidding, really? What they're providing with their iPhone these days?
Right, in ear concha, intraconchal or earbuds, and you have to make a real specific thing here to go in ear monitors with a tip that seal your ear canal is one thing, and then the concha earbuds, the ones that rest in your concha, are a completely different thing. And as a category, earbuds, the ones that rest in your concha, are absolutely the most horrid of all types of headphones because you don't get a sealed, you don't get bass response and blah blah blah. And he was asking about bass response in particular because they don't have bass response, but the ear pods do as good, pretty much as good as you can get. There's one called a UNPK1. It's a $150 earbud that it sounds a little bit better. But the Apple EarPods actually are a fantastic earbud.
Wow. Who would have thunk?
And then somebody else asked about they have a pair of Beyerdynamic DT880 600 ohm headphones for classical music, and if there was an upgrade worth under $700 that's worthwhile. And in some ways, I would say no, not really. But there may be a good sideways maneuver for a different character with the Sennheiser HD600s. So I just wanted to throw that out there for him.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I did see that one. That was one of my questions that I was going to pass along there. Let's see. Oh, Barfel, by the way, getting back to that question about the amp, the headphone amp and the AVR, right, and where should he put it and so on. Right. He was mostly concerned about power connections, convenience, level controls. If the level control is on that little amp and it doesn't have a wireless remote, then right, I would say the answer is to use a longer interconnect to get that right thing up near you so you have actual physical access to it, right?
You know, and the third, yes, that's correct. And I'd say that there is a third alternative that may be worth considering, which is to get a pair of the Sennheiser wireless headphones. These are base station wireless headphones. So it has a base station. You put the headphones on and it charges, and then you connect your receiver to it, and then you run wirelessly to wherever you are, and it's got its own volume control on it. And almost without exception, all the Sennheiser wireless headphones for that purpose are really and truly a very, very good value for money. So that may not be the way he chooses to go, but if you want to go with wireless headphones for a home theater environment, the Sennheiser stuff is fantastic. You got to take a real hard look at the detail of the features, though. Their top of the line one is really mostly for people with hearing impairment, and it has various amounts of compression that it can do, and also speech intelligibility enhancement and stuff like that. So you don't need to go to the top of the line. One down from the top of the line is plenty good for it's about as good as you can get for most people.
Yeah. Beatmaster is asking, when you aren't testing, do you get to just sit back and enjoy music without analyzing it on a technical level? This is actually a very good question. And the question is, when you do, what headphones do you use for that? It's a question related to the question that I get as a musician of, you know, when I go hear somebody else play, can I just sit back and listen and enjoy the music? Or am I always sort of, is my musical analytical brain always on?
Yeah.
So what's your answer to this question?
Boy, it's just a horrible answer.
Uh-oh.
the horrible truth is that when you choose something to do as a profession, when you choose something you love to do as a profession, yep, yeah, there's that old saying, you never work a day in your life because you love what you do. But you burn out on that enthusiast part. The enthusiast aspect isn't really there anymore for me. Mm. And I have to tell you that the most enjoyment I get out of music is when I'm mowing my lawn, when I'm working in the garage and using in-ear monitors and just doing stuff. And yeah, but I very rarely anymore just sit back and relax and listen to music. I do, but it doesn't happen as much as it used to happen.
Mm-hmm. I'm afraid the same is true for me in a sense. You know, I love working on AVS Forum and so on, but yeah, when it's time to leave the computer, I leave the computer. Yeah. I don't stay there and continue to be an enthusiast because it's my job. You know,
right.
I mean, if it were my hobby, I would spend what time I could there, but then I also have another job that I'm spending a lot of time on. But it's a tricky thing.
I had a friend who said to me one time, be careful when you make your avocation into your vocation, because then you're going to have to find another avocation.
Yep. Couldn't agree more.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I ride motorcycles.
Your avocation is your riding. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Okay. Zariah Heap. great screen name. What exactly does sound stage mean in headphones? How can a headphone define the sound stage of non-binaural recordings?
Right. That's a good point. Part of me will say there is none. It's just not natural. And so any normal sense of sound stage and imaging that you get from stereo is in the sense that you get it from speakers is non-existent on headphones. Mm. But when you spend a lot of time with headphones, again, your brain is a powerful thing and it's going to want to make a sound stage because that's what it's used to. And so headphone enthusiasts use the word head stage a lot of times. There are headphones that clearly seem to present a deeper, wider image than other headphones that seem more closed and in your face. The sound never really gets out of your head. I would say that in some ways it's like extra dimensional. It's that you, if you close your eyes and you don't move and you forget the outside world is there, that you have a sense of space where the music is. But if you open your eyes and say, okay, where is that? You really can't do anything but, you know, something like this, you know, maybe a little bit
of cognitive dissonance going on there.
Yeah. Yeah. So there really isn't a sound stage like there is on speakers, but there is an analog that you develop. That develops over time and that some headphones are clearly better than others. For example, the Sennheiser HD800 is famously the best imaging headphone out there. I think it's because it has incredible transient response and is able to so cleanly define edges of things. So there is such a thing, but it's really not like regular imaging at all.
What about what we were talking a little earlier about the immersive possibilities with headphones, immersive soundstage,
sure.
And so on.
Right.
And I've heard demos of DTS:X where it really sounds like the sound is coming from speakers outside of your head.
Yeah.
And I want, you know, that would be an example of that, but that's using a lot of DSP.
That's DSP, right. That's magic. Yeah, that's... There's a lot of work that goes into that.
Yeah, true.
And they're not there yet.
No. Although the what's it called? The Smith Realizer.
Yeah.
Gets pretty close.
Well, I tell you another one that's sort of similar to the Smith Realizer. It's a company called Out of Your Head. And
oh yeah, yeah.
Darren Fong is the guy that runs that place. Yeah. And what he does, so the Smith Realizer thing, there's a generic head-related transfer function and that they can use for demo purposes. But if you buy one to properly have it calibrated, you have to sit in front of some speakers with microphones in your ears, not all the way up your ear canals, but right at the entrance to your ear canals. And the system calibrates using your ears and your physical system. So in a way, that's a cheat because you're literally just recording and then mimicking the transfer function of your own ears. And Darren Fong's Out of Your Head is kind of like that in that he goes and visits people with really, really great stereo and home theater systems and has calibrated tones that he plays with microphones in his ear canals and he records these chirp tones to create DSP filters, which mimic the sound of that system getting to your ears. And it's fairly good, but there's no adjustments to it. You can, you know, and you're listening to particular audio systems, so to speak, you get the transfer function from them.
I'm going to have to revisit. I heard a very early prototype of his Out of Your Head system and, mm-hmm. It wasn't fully baked, but I haven't heard it since, and I bet you it's come a long way. So I would definitely have to do that.
It sounds pretty good, and the really if somebody's really interested in doing it, they ought to go to a show that he's at. Like he's going to be at RMAF, for example. I know
Rocky Mountain Audio Fest in October. Is he going to be at a THE show in Newport?
Newport, I think he might be, but I'm not really sure because I think he lives in the area in Southern California. But at any rate, you should bring your own headphones because that's part of the magic of this thing is the how the transducers act, and he has You have to buy his software sort of filter by filter by filter. And he's got a couple of dozen or maybe more now of systems that he's recorded. And for me, when I different people did the recordings on different systems. He sent his gear to somebody else, and they put it in their ears. So it's some of the systems are recorded with different ears, not necessarily his. And right. So some of them work better than others for me, and probably for anybody. So it's a good idea to go list, have a particular, if you're interested in it, have a particular piece of music or interested in your headphones, and then try a number of his different filters beforehand so you can know which one you like and then pick that one.
Mm-hmm. SoundPro 69 is asking, I love the spacious sensation of Stax headphones. I do too. Mm-hmm. Is there any other type of headphones that might be less bulky but can provide a good open sensation?
Well, I'm glad he put it that way, this sort of open sensation, because it's not, again, it's not real, you know, in headphones.
Yeah, it's a trick, yeah.
Yeah, it's some sound more open than others, and for reasons that maybe that it's just a little distorted in a very happy way. I'll give you, for instance, the Hi-Fi Man HE1000. Now, this is a $3,000 headphone, and I apologize for recommending
well,
a $3,000.
Well, the Stax are even more than that.
Well, they have less expensive Stacks. But
oh, do they? Oh, okay.
Sure, right. Yeah. So, there are less expensive ones than the 009. And in fact, they just came out with two new models that are in the lower price ranges, and I've heard good things about them. I haven't heard them yet, but I've heard good things about them.
Okay. Anyway, getting back to the Hi-Fi Man.
Yeah, I would say the Hi-Fi Man does that in a kind of an odd sort of way. It sounds spacious and fun. The Sennheiser HD800S, the new one, this is a $1,600 headphone. It is unbelievable in terms of its ability to create a sense of space. But that's a very expensive headphone. In the lower cost areas, boy, it would be hard to point at any one in particular. Maybe the Hi-Fi Man HE400S is a good one, but it's such a subtle thing and sort of such a secondary thing that I tend not to remember headphones based on their imaging capability. It's more on their tonal character and dynamics.
Yeah. Well, Web7429 asked a question that I wanted to ask you as well, which is, you must have heard the Sennheiser Orpheus, which we're talking about expensive headphones.
The new one or the old one?
Let's talk a little bit about both of them. I have never heard either of them. In fact, at CES, I went by the Sennheiser booth and I said, gee, I'd love to get in there and hear the Orpheus, which are these, you know, massively expensive headphones.
$55,000.
Now, that gets you an amp as well with the cool tubes that rise out of a solid stone base, you know, blah, blah, blah. Right. And you know, oh, well, let's see. We can schedule you for Tuesday at 5 if you want.
Right.
There was this long line and appointments being made to hear these headphones.
Right.
What's your impression of them? You must have heard them.
Well, I did. In fact, Sennheiser was kind enough to fly me down at their expense to Los Angeles for one of the press junkets they were having down there with that headphone. Mm-hmm. And you know, a headphone like that, you just can't make a snap judgment from a few minutes of listening. It sounded very nice. It sounded very, very good. But I'd have to set it down next to some 009s and other headphones of that ilk and spend some time with it. The old Orpheus that cost $17,000 at the time. $17,000 at the time. It was nice because it was a little smoother and mellower sounding than a lot of the electrostatics. The 009 is a bit too quick sounding for me personally, and has some haziness to it up there. But I'll tell you a funny story about the first Orpheus, because I used to sell those things when I was at Headroom, and I got a phone call once. And we sold 14 of them.
Wow.
Three of them to one guy.
What does one guy need three sets of headphones, much less three sets of $17,000 headphones for?
So here's how it goes. A guy calls me up. Hi, I'm from Texas. I have a nice little plot down here, a nice little house, got a beautiful stereo. I love the look of that Orpheus. Would you just send one down to me? Yes, sir. Took his credit card, send it down to him. Okay. 3 months later, I get a phone call. Ah, yeah, I love that Orpheus. It's just absolutely gorgeous sounding. But, you know, I got two speakers and my rack in the middle. And then I had my carpenter guy make me a plinth for the Orpheus on one side. But now it's asymmetrical. And so now I need another one so I can have a matching pair so it balances out with my speakers. Yes, sir. Wrote it down. 3 months later, I get a phone call from him. He says, you ain't going to believe what happened. So I love them Orpheuses so dang much, I ended up bringing one up to my bedroom. And now I've got it on my nightstand, and I just love it. But now I'm back to being asymmetrical in my living room, so can you send me another one? So that
that's
my Orpheus story. I bought three of them.
Three of them, just so they could have one in his bedroom and two in his living room so that they would look symmetrical.
Yeah, and in the for what it's worth category, they go for in good condition. They go for around $30,000-$40,000 now on eBay. So the old ones.
Wow. Let's see here. I got a couple more questions. We're just about out of time, but let's see. Oh, Invention LWS. What do you think of the reason why a lot of 2+ way IEMs in-ear monitors, 2-way in-ear monitors, have out of phase drivers? Is this intentional?
Yeah.
I had never heard that before.
Yeah. Well, you know how if you look at the impulse response of a 3-way speaker, a lot of times it'll go negative first. The tweeter will be out of phase with the other two elements, but it gets back in phase by the time you get a certain distance away because of path length difference. So you're aware of that, right? That the impulse response of a 3-way speaker can sometimes go negative first.
Yeah. Yeah.
And because the tweeter is sort of out of phase. And I think it's kind of like that to get it to transition smoothly without running into phase problems in the crossover and stuff like that, they do it that way. But I think the actual issue is maybe quite a bit more complicated than that in an area that I don't know enough about. But Jerry Harvey at Jerry Harvey Audio has in their line these freak phase IEMs where they did a lot of work to just perfectly balance the impulse response of the various elements, and mostly by making the tubes longer and shorter. One aspect of it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I can tell you that one of my all-time favorite multi-balanced armature IEMs is the Shure 535, and it has that in it, and it's not bothered me. So I think it's one of those things where, yeah, it looks weird, but, you know, it's more complicated and not necessarily intuitive why and that it may be okay. But I don't know enough about it to make an authoritative statement one way or another.
Okay. Okay, that's fine. So last question. Are you going to be at Axpona in Chicago coming up in a few weeks? They're asking if you and or I will. I'm not going to be. But my colleague Mark Henninger from AVS Forum, I believe, will be.
No, I'm not going to be there either. My next show will be Newport and then RMAF after that. And in August, I'm going to the Audio Engineering Society Headphone Conference in Denmark, which should be a whole lot of fun. So,
wow, that should be great. You'll be reporting on that.
And in May, is it May? I think it's May. In May, there's a Canlanta. You have to kind of search around for Canlanta. There's a post on headfi.org, and I'll be going to that as well. And that's sort of a headphone meet kind of thing. And I'm actually really excited about getting back to a smaller meet. So
That's in May and presumably in Atlanta.
In Atlanta, yeah, it's in Atlanta. Mm-hmm.
And then THE, The Home Entertainment Show, Newport Beach here in L.A., in Irvine, actually. That's first weekend in June, I think.
I don't remember, but yeah,
I'm pretty sure that's when it is. Expona in Chicago. There's the New York audio show. There's a bunch of shows where you can hear a bunch of headphones. And I think the meet, the Canlanta, as you said, is one good place to one way for people to get together and hear all kinds of different headphones, all kinds of different amps, all kinds of different DIY projects and mods, modifications to existing products. So if you're into headphones, any one of these shows would be a great way to go. And at some of you'll see
also the can jams that are put on by HeadFi are good. It used to be that it was a better mixture of exhibits from enthusiasts and exhibits from vendors. And now it's gotten kind of so big that those two activities are sort of splitting up. But if you want to listen to a lot of headphones from manufacturers, those can jams are a great way to go. They really have the most variety of headphones. And there's a can jam at the Rocky Mountain Audio Fest, but they are now separated out and they do their own shows. There was just one this last weekend in the Orange County area. And I don't know. The next one will be at Rocky Mountain Audio Fest. And they had one in Indonesia some months ago. So keep your eye out for a can jam somewhere near you.
Rocky Mountain Audio Fest is in Denver, obviously, and it is in October, I think, right after Cedia. Right after Cedia. So plenty of opportunities there and plenty of information here. Tile Hertzens, thanks so much for being on the show again and answering everybody's questions.
Hey, you're welcome, Scott. Anytime. I love hanging out with you for an afternoon.
Yeah, I sure love it too. And you can get a lot more of Tile at his website, innerfidelity.com, where you'll read all sorts of interesting stuff about headphones, headphone amps, and so on. And now he's got a correspondent, Bob Katz, who's been on this show, who's a recording engineer of long and illustrious career, who's now writing for Tile on Inner Fidelity. So go check that out for that as well. You can always find me at avsforum.com. You can email me at scott@twit.tv, and you can follow me on Twitter at htgeekscott and at avsforum. You can always find previous episodes of Home Theater Geeks right here at twit.tv/htg and on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/twit/HomeTheaterGeeks. Next week, I hope to have someone from Vizio on the show to talk about the new P-Series TVs, which were launched this week to tremendous fanfare, and they look to be some serious game-changing products. That hasn't been confirmed wholly yet, but I'm still holding out hope. If it's not them, it'll be somebody interesting, I'm sure, so I hope you will join us. Until then, geek out.